stop it, brother. Let's get together, yeah, unified. Trouble.
Radio Basics. And there's always a message involved.
Greetings, Toronto. You're listening to Radio Basics here on CHRY 105.5 FM. And I'm joined in the studios tonight with my co-host, Kabir Joshua Vijayan. How you doing, brother?
Doing good.
And also a guest host for tonight, Hakeem Al-Masri, an Egyptian-Canadian who will be talking with us about the situation, the ongoing developments in Egypt. He's been speaking to people on the ground. Thanks for joining us tonight, brother.
Thank you for having me.
So on the show tonight, we will be discussing the ever-changing and rapidly developing situations in Egypt and the Middle East.
Well, it seems now that the whole world is watching what's happening in Tunisia and Egypt. Some people call it an internet-driven revolution. Some people see it as a youthful, romantic expression of protest. Others fear that it's a growing presence of extremist forces. But beneath all these images, however, there's a visible popular uprising against an oppressive set of dictatorships that has put the status quo at unease. Today on Radio Basics, we're going to be talking to Dr. Amir Hassanpour, a retired professor from the University of Toronto, in an attempt to understand and learn from these developments back home. And we're going to be taking a bit of a break, but we're also going to be listening to a song by an Egyptian protest singer, a folk protest singer from back in the day, from between the 50s and 70s, Sheikh Imam, who wrote a number of anthems for protests for people who opposed the dictatorships in the past, since 1980, and opposition movements since then. And the song is going to be called Masri Yamma Ya Bahiyya, which means Egypt, oh, like basically the beautiful. And it's sort of a hopeful, but also a bit of a sarcastic protest song as well, in its typical style.
And when we come back, Egypt and the Middle East with Amir Hassanpour, Radio Basics.
يسبق كلامنا سلامنا يطوف عالسامعين معنا عصفور محندق يزقزق كلام موزون وله معنى عن أرض صمرا وغاضة ونهري ومراكي ورفاء مسيرة عسيرة وسورة حشد ومواكب عيون صبية بهية عليها الكلمة والمعنى مصر يما يا بهية يا ام طرحة وجلابية الزمن شاب وانت شابه ورايح وانت جاية مصر يما يا بهية يا ام طرحة وجلابية الزمن شاب وانت شابه هو رايح وانت جاية جاية فوق الصعب ماشية فات عليك ليل ومية واحتمالك هو وابتسامتك هي تضحكي للصبح يصبح بعد ليلة ومغربية تطلع الشمس تلاقيكي مجنونية وصبية يا بهية ¶¶
الليل جزائر جزائر مد البحر يبنيها والفجر شعلة حتى على والشط باين ملاين عليها الشمس ضوافة يركبنا ساعدنا لمهما الموجة تتعافى بالعزم ساعة جماعة وبالإصرار نخطيها مصر يما يا سفينة مهما كان البحر عاتي فلاحينك ملاحينك يزعقون الريح يواتي مصر يما يا سفينة مهما كان البحر عاتي فلاحينك ملاحينك يزعقون الريح يواتي اللي عاد
this is CHRY 105.5 FM. This month is African Liberation Month. Stay tuned all February for the culture, the history, the struggles, and the liberation that unites Africans across time and across continents. Listen, discuss, celebrate.
Radio Basics, we're back in the studio with you here on CHOI 105.5, and I'm joined in the studio with my co-host for today, Kabir and Hakim. And our topic of the show today is Egypt and the situations developing across the Middle East. On the show with us today is Amir Hassanpour, a recently retired professor of the Department of Near and Middle Eastern Civilizations at the University of Toronto. Amir Hassanpour has taught at Canadian universities for the past 25 years and was a political activist in Iran in the 1960s and in the U.S. in the 1970s. He is currently working on a history of the peasant uprising of Kurdistan in 1952 and 53, and of course as a historian and activist of the Middle East, a close follower of developments in the region. Amir Hassanpour, thank you for being on the show with us tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure to talk to you and your audience.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So, Amir, the majority of the world is well aware, and I'm sure listeners are well aware of the inspirational developments that have been taking place over the past few weeks in North Africa and the Middle East. Can you explain some of the political and economic circumstances that led to these waves of uprisings in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, and in other countries in this region, beyond, I guess, you know, as is always often the case, the individual actions that are often, you know, latched onto by the media, but more the general political and economic conditions that led up to these revolts, people's revolts?
Yeah, well, I should say that in all these countries in North Africa, and I would say in many other parts of the world, in Latin America and in the rest of Africa and Asia, the condition is one in which the majority of the population is living in poverty and unemployment, poverty, and in time we see true polarization in terms of extreme wealth on the one hand and extreme poverty on the other hand. But also at the same time in the Middle East, in the countries where we have seen this popular uprising in especially the urban centers, we see also dictatorial regimes which have been in power quite often, and I would say in most of these cases, through the direct interference of Western imperialist powers.
Mm.
So they have kept these regimes in power by giving them military assistance and through, of course, economic ties. And then, you know, they have turned North Africa and the Middle East into a really a prison house of those who oppose this order in the region, if you can call it an order. I would say these are some of the contradictions that have led to this revolt. But, of course, the context is, like, this region of the world has been revolting since the latter part of the 19th century. But what distinguishes these revolts, one aspect of it is the development of these societies in terms of, let's say, urbanization. Now we have big urban centers. Cairo was always the largest urban concentration engine. You know, today Cairo is about 15 million, some say even more. And there are other major cities, and for the first time, the region urbanization is a huge factor in the political forces. Like, and also new composed of events allowed the popular opera. One feature, that the fact that they are, reminds me of the Nine in Europe.
Role that to would you be able to touch on in his regimeism in four?
Yeah, well, Hosni Mubarak, a number of Sadat and assassination, Nasser, military historiographies, not in the sense nationalist, and 1950s. The Nasser takes to limit, you know, with Sadat, of course, you know, we all know extensive events in his about $1 billion of me. I was in 2000, amazing for me to stay there, but it was major, you know, where would be checked in boarding and see, you know, on either side, the army was gone, embassy, military still was able to deal, and Israel, we fond of him, very unhappy. And they, so, United States, you know, I'm the new first president would block.
There was this was, you know, a terroristic act that was you know, the port of that, and, you know, enforced, I believe, through, right? The Middle East has a complete lack of any kind.
It's important. The U.S. and Canada intent on in favor of a like transition is his clear. Would you agree?
I think you're right. What's happening, but keep hopeful and people go to the homes and the streets of here, and they can reorganize the streets, the United States, and Israel already on other regimes like that. It'll be there, I think. But, you know, there's one difference to in terms of Prime Minister Harper's position when he was in the White House recently, while President Obama was a little ambiguous on whether Sadat should remain in power. Prime Minister Harper was clearly, quite clear on it, that he should stay.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's, I mean, this consistent with his politics. And
yeah, one of the most, you know, unabashed supporters of dictatorships, Israel, just tyrannical regimes all across the world, just completely unashamed.
Right.
You know, Amir, I find it it's ironic that I think that in Canada right now we see kind of a convergence of voices, whether it be from the conservatives to some groups on the left that have been very quick to anoint what's happening throughout the Middle East and in Egypt as revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, with the, you know, with the political officials, they say that this is a democratic revolution. We now have a process that is in place
in line with, like, you know, what happened in Ukraine or whatever the so-called color revolutions, right, that were
and many you know, groups on the left have been seemingly very quick to call this revolution as well. Would you agree with this characterization of what's happening throughout the Middle East and in Egypt, and maybe you can talk a little bit more particularly about what classes and strata of people have been involved in these revolts?
Yeah, I would say we cannot call it a revolution, but the whole development, like beginning in Tunisia and now in the rest of the region, you know, has created a situation in which these regimes cannot rule the way they have been ruling for much of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And quite recently, I mean, especially today, there was talk of Syria, Jordan, you know, also giving concessions to the people in Yemen too.
Yeah.
To reform the system so that there won't be such a large-scale pouring of the people into the streets. So it's surely a situation in which those in power are in disorder. We can see a situation of disorder among them to the very top of the United States, which has been guarding the system and helping constructing it. So, and then the people, of course, are definitely fed up. You know, there are still people in the streets. They sleep in the Al Tahrir Square, and they don't want to leave to make sure that Sadat Mubarak goes.
Mubarak.
Yeah. So there are two features of a revolution which exists in the present situation. But the other factor is, while the people in the streets in both Tunisia and here and in Egypt are determined to get rid of the politicians at the top, I would say it won't be revolution unless a third factor is also present, and that's revolutionary politics of transforming the present regime of in which, you know, the capitalists and the capitalists as a class rule through the instrument of the state. Unless that and, you know, a new class politics is at the realm and changing the situation and creating a new political, social, economic system, or going towards that, I wouldn't call it a revolution until that happens. But on the other level, because revolution has so many meanings, I think we can claim that these waves of popular uprisings that are happening are of revolutionary significance.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, I invoke or raise the point not to diminish the absolute historical significance of what's occurring. And you know, it seems like if...
Or the inspiration it can serve to, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So they are extremely, I think, significant. And the region won't be the same, even if the United States and these regimes are able to make some reforms and some concessions. Like, you know, some elections in which, you know, some of the opposition can get into the parliament. Things like this are possible. Like, you know, in Turkey, this has been the case for quite some time. So, and that certainly wouldn't be a revolutionary outcome. But still, you know, it's a significant thing. All it shows is that from a social movement's perspective, you know, one should look at it at the outcome too. It's great what has happened. I think is really indicates that the potential for this into turning into a revolution is there. It's a spontaneous struggle, but I'm sure all of us have heard the news of how people have their own order in the streets. You know, there are some of the enmities that existed, like between the Christian Egyptians and Muslim dominant Muslim population, which was, the relation was very stressful in recent years. You know, there were attacks on churches, on individuals. Like, you know, during this the last 2 weeks, these conflicts have gone away. You know, there are youth as a new force, a political force, women, all generations are there. So, and people are helping each other. Like, you know, there are some people have offered their homes as a shelter for those who have run away in a few places from police repression. So all the indications that this is, you know, has the potential of becoming a revolution is there. And these are very, very significant. We shouldn't underestimate. And we I myself, you know, I'm really happy to see that so many people are doing such amazing struggle and helping each other, you know, unity in opposing Mubarak. All of this are extremely significant.
Definitely. Now, in terms of what you were talking about, the need for a class consciousness or for some kind of, you know, the goal being more than just the overthrow of Mubarak, but the some kind of transformation of the socioeconomic system that's in place. What, from your understanding, in terms of the composition of the protesters, what is the class composition when we're talking about the demonstrators and we're talking about the people that are, like you said, camping or there 24 hours a day in the square? What is that class composition? What maybe you could even give us, from your understanding, like a breakdown of the situation in Egypt, like the social situation in Egypt, the class situation in Egypt. I read something recently about 30% of Egyptians being slum dwellers, that this being a, you know, a huge percentage of the population that's been excluded. What percent of the population is, represents the peasantry? And so what class forces are present within the uprisings, and which of them are absent?
Yeah, to the extent that we know, it's quite mixed. We know that the labor unions, although all of them were really under much pressure and stress, you know, in the last 30 years, the trade unions and the workers have been a factor all the time in keeping the momentum of struggle against this regime. And, of course, you know, slum dwellers in a city like Cairo or Alexandria or other cities, you know, they are certainly there. In terms of percentages, I really don't know, and I haven't had access to information about the proportion of classes participating in it. All I have been able to understand is that it's quite mixed. Of course, there's a more it's more urban than rural, and quite mixed in terms of class composition.
And and seems to be a large number of students as well.
Students, the youth, all groups of youth, and also this secularity of slogans is very important. Another thing, the thing is about the class composition. What would really affect such a situation is whether each of these classes has a political representative that would be able to direct this revolutionary change, you know, towards a revolution. In other words, definitely there is a there is an Egyptian working class, but the point is that this working class without its own party, and not just any party, it's a party that's able to understand the situation, theoretically aware of its own position in Egyptian society and in Egyptian history and the world, and capable of, you know, having enough organization to raise demands and slogans that people in the street would accept and follow and, you know, come to power. I think that would determine the role of the classes. But otherwise, you know, let's say the working class without its own party consciousness and organization will unfortunately eventually, whatever they do in the streets or in the factories, would be used by, let's say, people like Al-Baradei, if he comes to power or becomes a leading figure, or any of the other groups, Ikhwan al-Muslimin or WAFT or whatever, you know. If the working class doesn't have its own party and consciousness, then others would lead the working class.
Well, you mentioned the secularity of a lot of the slogans that were mentioned. Also, you mentioned Ikhwan al-Muslimin, the Muslim Brotherhood. Oftentimes we see in the mainstream media in the West, the corporate press, the existence of the Brotherhood is often invoked to, or is often brought in to invoke fear over what the revolts could lead to create a sense of not wanting to upset the stability of the status quo. For you, what do you feel the role of the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, has played as a force in Egyptian recent Egyptian history, and have they been have they been a very relevant force in the demonstrations, as you find, or has their presence mostly been invoked to draw support away from the uprisings, do you feel?
Well, if you ask, you know, Egyptian politicians or those who watch the situation in Egypt closely, they would say that the Ikhwan al-Muslimin really, in an election, in a free election, they wouldn't get more than 30% of the vote. That's there's a general consensus that that's how they'll perform. Politically, you know, in recent years, the Muslim Brotherhood have been actually not as radical as the mainstream Western media portray them.
Yeah.
And in recent days, of course, you know, 2 weeks ago when this struggles began, they were nowhere there. They were not a factor in this uprising. But after 4 or 5 years, you know, they showed up. Their slogans appeared here and there. And now, of course, quite recently, last 2-3 days, they went to talk to the authorities while the people in the streets don't want such a contact between the authorities and the opposition. But I think what they do is they try to become a larger force in Egyptian politics by negotiating at the same time, you know, claiming some of their leaders have said they are opposed to negotiation as long as Mubarak is in power, while the another leader goes to talk to the authorities. So they try to have both to be in both seats and see how the situation goes.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I think they have a very opportunistic policy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in a similar way, like there's the AKP party in Turkey, which for the listeners, I guess, is a liberal Islamist party that made considerable gains in Turkish politics. To the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, there's the Al Nahda party in Tunisia as well, which is also is attempting to be sort of like a similar liberal Islamist party. The Muslim Brotherhood seems to be doing the same thing. Do you find that this is like a new trend in these politics, where these outlawed Islamist parties are taking influence from that Turkish style of liberal Islamism? Could that be a significant force in the next couple of years?
I think you are right. I think, you know, in the worst situation, when the United States won't be able to determine everything in the politics of the region, they would opt for something like Turkey. However, in the case of Turkey, of course, you know, Turkey had, after the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire in 1918 and the rise of Turkish nationalism and Kemal Atatürk, you know, in that regime, secularism was a major factor in the formation of the Turkish Republic and Turkish nationalism. So, you know, the Islamist party that has been in power in recent years in Turkey is very cautious, you know. They always say that they do believe in the principle of separation of what in the West they call church and state, here in this case mosque and the state. You know, they try, you know, to abide by this traditions of secularism, of Turkish nationalism. In the case of Ikhwan al-Muslimin, I think they'll compromise with the United States and Israel in Egypt. But surely Israel, in any way, because they think anything Islamic, Islam is Islam for them. Anything Islamic is not for them is a potential source of danger, so they wouldn't be very happy with a moderate Islam. But I think overall, the United States and European Union, they really, what they desire for the region is a moderate Islamic regime which will be in control of the population and also pro-EU and pro-United States and pro-Israel. I think that that's what they opt for if this kind of struggles go on. You know, that's what they want. They don't want secular regimes.
You know, as maybe one of our concluding questions, you know, I'm wondering that yourself as a Kurdish national from Iran, you know, also a victim of the terror that, you know, preceded the Islamic regime there, and also everything we've seen since 1979. I'm wondering if, you know, looking back at, say, the uprisings that swept Iran in 2009, after the popular backlash when Ahmadinejad was ostensibly re-elected, if you would draw any parallels between the situation that unfolded there and what we're seeing across the Middle East in terms of composition of forces, demands being made, you know, secularity versus theocracy, and maybe potential outcomes.
Yeah, well, that one too, the major center of opposition to the Ahmadinejad faction of the government was in Tehran, although in some major cities also there were some struggles. But Tehran was the main center of this activism. Over there, the you know, people, especially the youth, again, the youth were a major force. And women's presence in those struggles were really quite visible. But also, you know, it was cross-generational. There were other generations too, previous generations, and all political tendencies. And the movement got more radicalized. So from the demand, you know, what happened to our votes, you know, they went to the overthrow of the Islamic theocracy. Over there, the leadership of the movement went into the hands of two of the candidates for the position of the president of the republic, Mousavi, especially Mousavi, became the most prominent. And you know, it ended up in what they called the Green Movement. The leaders of the Green Movement, unfortunately, that's what happened. They used this public dissatisfaction with the results of the elections in order to actually have a better share in the government and to join the other faction, you know, with more power. Although they didn't get all of it, they are still there. You know, they are still part of this regime, and they acted as a historical break, as fetters to the unfolding of the struggle. In Egypt, you know, the Mubarak regime has not been able to do it. But what I see as a problem there too, which is similar to the leadership of the Green Movement, is that the claim that the army is neutral, and that's, I think, quite dangerous. If the situation really goes out of hand for the United States and for the Egyptian state, I'm talking about the institution of the state, the army is there. This army is has been fortified, trained, and financed by the United States. The top echelons of it are part of the U.S. Army. They'll move against the Egyptian people if you know, they think everything has gone out of control. So it will be, it may end up something along the lines of Iran, where the army, you know, in this case in Egypt, the army would maintain the state structure.
Seems quite analogous to, like, maybe the situation in Pakistan as well, in terms of the army's relationship. Well, Amir Hassanpour, that's pretty much all we have for the interview. We have to go to a commercial break, but I want to thank you very much for being on the show with us tonight.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you and talk to you.
Thank you.
Bye.
That was Amir Hassanpour, a recently retired professor from the University of Toronto, a Kurdish national of Iranian background, Iranian you know, left Iran in the 1970s in the midst of the Shah's political repression, I believe, and became an activist and eventually a scholar, a historian here in North America, but also still a very important, prominent activist in the community. Radio Basics, we're going to go to commercial break, and we're going to be continuing this conversation with our guest host for today, Hakeem Al-Masri, who's in the studio with us. And yeah, you've been in touch with a lot of people on the ground, right?
Yes, I have, and hopefully we can have a bit of an in-depth discussion after we come back from the break and give you a report
sure.
back.
Definitely. Our guest host today, Hakeem, has some really important voices, reports from what's happening on the ground. So we'll be back with that. Radio Basics and CHOI 105.5.
It's Sunday morning early. You don't want to party and you don't want to sleep. What do? You turn your radio on. You select 105.5 FM. You listen. You hear the melodic tones of yesteryear and the high-paced frenzy of today's reggae. You've found the right fix for your musical insomnia. Sir B with Cool Runnings.
This is the Midnight Cool Ruler. Join me, Sir B, every Saturday night from 12 till 3.
History is a prophet who looks back. Because of what was and against what was, it announces what will be. You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM during African Liberation Month. Listen, discuss, celebrate.
Radio Basics, we're back. We've been talking about Egypt and the developments unfolding in the Middle East right now. And our guest host with us tonight, Hakeem Al-Masri, is in the studio. And you've been in touch with family, friends, people on the ground in Egypt. And we'd like to hear, we want to hear what people are thinking, what people are doing, how people are dealing with the current situation. But maybe you can also just, quick overview, in a nutshell, the last 12 days, which really is like historical developments amounting to like decades of it's so incredible what's happened in the last 12 days. So in a nutshell, what has happened?
Well, the first reaction from a number of people around the Arab world and around the world in general, when these things first broke out, was finally, you know, Egypt, yeah. Cairo particularly is it's the biggest city in the Arab world. Egypt has for a long time played like a central cultural production role in terms of politics, just even in terms of size and just the history of politically of the Egyptian people in the past 100 plus years. For them to be under a dictatorship for that long, many people did find themselves sort of disappointed with the Egyptian people. And finally, when January 25th came around and the mass protests began and the stories that we're seeing all around the world since, people finally, something is happening. But every day has been a different thing.
Every day.
Every day has been a different thing.
And more and more every day, support kind of withering away from Mubarak and the international community with very mixed positions, more or less, but in essence very fearful about what's happening.
Can you tell, I mean, as you're saying, obviously in a situation where it is very much, I mean, we're talking about the kind of problematic or maybe not problematic, but you know, characterizations that don't really fit with what's going on, but when it's a spontaneous movement, when there's, you know, as you're saying, things change every day. But can you talk about some general trends that we've seen in terms of, like, you know, the earlier dates, the initiation of the demonstrations? You know, most recently we've seen like it seemed to be an upsurge in repression, maybe not directly through any kind of armed force, but through these paid kind of goons that went in. And then now, you know, presently, what's the situation? Which according to media reports seems to have calmed down a little bit.
Well, in Egypt, there's been a couple of significant uprisings in the past 20 or 30 years. There was conscription riots, and in the late 70s, early 80s, there was bread riots. There was a number of uprisings regarding students. One scandal in the past 10 or so years was because a lot of the government-subsidized bread is usually of very poor quality and oftentimes has, like, lead. So there's the uprisings against that, but Egypt tends to have an incredibly repressive security culture. The army and the police are very present, particularly the police, which is sort of the right hand of the Mubarak regime. a very prominent sort of intelligence service as well. So it what it took when Tunisia sort of had a very significant and what seemed to be a successful popular uprising, I think it gave people a lot of courage. So in a sense, like you were saying, there in terms of the trends, it is a little difficult to say because it is a spontaneous mass uprising.
For sure.
One of the things that is surprising, though, is as Dr. Hassanpour was mentioning earlier, the general secularity of the of a lot of the chants, the slogans, the fact that there was a lot of fears of sectarian violence in Egypt. Particularly, there was a bombing of a church in Alexandria, and that's always been one of the major sources of tension in Egypt.
When was this bombing?
This was, I believe, in the past month or so.
Yeah.
This was in the past
Okay.
Around the New Year, and for right. many people, this was a frightening development because
this was by the Muslim Brotherhood.
No. This was not by the Muslim Brotherhood. Didn't claim involvement. The Muslim Brotherhood, for the past several years, has mostly been attempting to sort of mold
change it
to
become
like
more
like a sort of a liberal political party, like an institutionalized. So nobody really claimed that kind of. But it was always a fear of this sectarian violence. So one of the things that was very surprising, and for many people a very positive thing, was that in some of the first days, you had like the first Friday, which is the Friday prayers, like a mass congregation in the city and around the Arab world in general. When people went to the prayer, there was a mass protest that was planned for afterwards. Mm-hmm. And while there was people praying inside the mosques, there was Christians, for example, outside, sort of holding the fort and preventing the police.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So what was greatest, like one of the greatest fears of people looking at Egypt was, you know, you saw these in many ways very inspiring images of people just getting over their sectarianism and getting over some what could have been very problematic divisions in their society.
Getting down to the common struggle.
Mm-hmm, which is when it comes to a president like Mubarak in Egypt, it's pretty, there's not too many people who support him. There's a very clear sort of clique. Even capitalists and people who have a lot of money, people who own businesses, things like this in Egypt, don't even like the president because they find him repressive in terms of that. So,
well, clearly he's not bringing stability. Right? His support has fallen away pretty quickly. It seems like all those who are in support of Mubarak, what they're concerned about is this peaceful transition, this stable transition towards something else. Where, you know, what we're hearing a lot in the Western press is that we're just concerned that the power vacuum will lead to radical elements coming.
Yeah,
in.
Yeah, which is basically a code word for not wanting, you know, a true change of as was put, you know, a true change in the in the economic social order, particularly in relation to Israel and their interests.
Yeah. Western leaders are being very blunt, like the Egyptian
our interest in Egypt, exactly.
Yeah. The Egyptian masses will not be hostile to the West. Will be hostile to the West. Will be hostile to Israel. And granted, they will. Why wouldn't they be? Like this is a regime that has oppressed them brutally. Mm-hmm. But you've had your pulse on the people.
Yes.
For weeks now, you've been calling family and friends and trying to figure out what's happening as of right now. Now yesterday there were some important developments. All of the opposition or pseudo opposition forces coming together, and there's this declaration with the Muslim Brotherhood as well, and there's a declaration that there will be some kind of transition process for reforms. So it's almost like telling them that they will be part of some kind of process, and the outcome will be favorable to them. What is the mood of the masses at this particular time?
It's interesting. There is at the beginning 2 weeks ago. It's amazing that this has only been in 2 weeks. It's just world changing developments. But what's been the case lately was there is sort of this sense of sort of not being exactly sure what's happening. It seems that like Egypt, for the listeners, Egypt is a very strategic country for the Western powers, for the United States and etc. 8 to 10% of world trade goes through the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
Egypt is a major exporter, for example, of cotton, for example. Egypt also as well in relationship to quote-unquote like counter-terrorism, in relation to being a major Arab ally with Israel. Egypt was a big piece on the playing board for the states, and it seems that this uprising caught many of the Western leaders by surprise, and you could quickly see them trying to reposture and looking for potential candidates. For example, they were looking, for example, at one of the sort of more liberal opposition leaders, Mohammed al-Baradei, who's he was affiliated with like the International Atomic Energy Association.
This is the guy that was brought back to the country, the Nobel Prize winner, I suppose.
He's somebody who's sort of well known in international diplomatic circles, and he's more liberal. He's a pro democracy reformist, but basically the White House was having discussions with him. You see them also trying to talk to people from the Brotherhood, people from different movements. But they're trying to see who to talk to, because they're like, it's been said more than once that Mubarak made more concessions than anybody, and he was the most important Arab leader, and in many ways the most important leader in the region to talk to. He was the big pawn for them, and the fact that they're losing him, they're scrambling for somebody else to talk to.
What about this new vice president, Omar Suleiman?
Yes, this particular gentleman, Omar Suleiman, is one of the more frightening figures to come out of politics. This is somebody who's sort of been in the back burner, sort of a very mysterious figure in Egyptian politics for the past couple of decades. He belongs to the old guard under Sadat, and he's been the chief of the General Intelligence Services, which I learned recently was actually was a more important intelligence contact for the West than the chief of the Mossad. He's somebody who, as one American diplomat puts it, somebody who is very smart, very realistic, and not squeamish about using torture. And in many cases, somebody who was spotted as almost, you could get the impression, going on his breaks from the intelligence services to go conduct torture himself.
Torture himself, yeah.
So he's a very controversial and very, like, if I can just be honest, disgusting figure, who is not trusted whatsoever. And you see him in a lot of the media, they're playing their games really well, the Egyptian establishment so far. He, in every one of his public statements, he makes claims that the opposition is divided. He sort of inserts very sort of smartly these...
he's writing the script as he goes along.
He's writing the script as he goes along, and the thing is, because of the control of the media, like, and the general influence that he has in the country, these lines tend to get picked up. He says the opposition is divided, and the next day... Oh. Back to Sheikh Iman. nice. Generally, the things that he introduces into the discourse get picked up very quickly.
And so you mentioned discussion earlier that he's been taking, particularly at this period, a more from the shadows, of torture chambers or whatever else, is seeming to have a larger role, more public role.
Yes.
And so what would you characterize that as? That he's been kind of touted as the leader of this supposed transition, or do you see him foreseeably being the United States man in the future?
Well, I think the one main thing, and this has been like a pretty significant concern, is that this uprising doesn't have a very clear leadership. And there's one thing that you see on the ground. It's in terms of Egyptian political culture, or Arab political culture in general, what's happening in Tunisia and Egypt and all over the Arab world, is some of the most repressive climates politically, where you phones are tapped if you gather in public. Like, Egypt's been under martial law since 1981, right? No public gatherings, nothing. And so for this, it's been pretty significant, but there's no real leadership. People are scrambling. People are trying to get things going. But so for a figure like Omar Suleiman to come to the forefront, Mubarak is sort of moving more into the background, and this frightening figure of Suleiman is coming to the forefront. And it almost seems that that he's being touted as a transition leader, or even worse, as perhaps the next leader. I mean, he's... the government is sort of being dissolved and reestablished, but it's the same sort of clique that's in power.
Same clique, and even more importantly, the same classes in the background. The whole class structure of Egypt, in terms of its, hasn't been challenged whatsoever. This is something that people, I think, we need to reiterate when talking about revolution, is that the social relations of the country have not been overturned. There are not strikes and road blockades crippling the country right across.
As in the case of Tunisia, we've seen, I think, a successful neutralizing of that. Not too completely. I mean, from my understanding, there's still demonstrations off and on that are, but definitely not the large scale, uprising that we saw, but there's been somewhat of a successful neutralizing of that of that, you know, if we want to call it revolutionary spirit that developed yeah. by, you know, initially, it was, remind me of the name.
Ben Ali.
And then there was the, you know, initiation of a new government with some of his former cabinet members, and they were shuffled out. And it seems
the prime minister remains in power.
The prime minister remains in power, but there were some key officials that was still a source of anger. But then even they were shuffled out. So there's been the successful dissolving of the, you know, individuals that caused particular chagrin, you know, among the population. But the of course the maintenance not only of the socioeconomic system but even the political structure has not changed. And perhaps that's the or most definitely that's the hope in terms of for Western leaders that will take place in Egypt and if it's necessary in Yemen.
Of course. Well, this has been one of the major things is that just on a Egyptian on like the streets on, in terms of what the people are experiencing. This like Egypt and many of the Arab countries will never go back to the way they were. Mm. This is there's been like the sense that this threshold has been crossed, that something has been broken. But also in a way, this is very illuminating for a lot of people who've been following the situation around the world, because there's even people who are sort of like naively in support of the sort of
the liberal pseudo opposition.
Just even in terms of like you see for example writers from the New York Times talking about the Egyptians want freedom too. There's this political cartoon of a sphinx sort of going through. Like a pet door, it's sort of like these very sort of naive and patronizing, sort of like these dirty masses. Oh, they've signed up for Twitter accounts and they want democracy too. This is it's entirely like
those venues have somehow like Facebook and Twitter somehow inspired people, or like that's what's led to this sudden realization of the
longing
for
liberal freedoms.
Of course,
right?
But the thing is that for example, when they shut down the internet, people in Egypt have had a long, and the Arab world in general have had a long history of organizing under repression. For example, even going back to like this liberal nationalist party, like the WEFT, for example, as far as the 1920s, had their leadership exiled. Would organize just for basic liberal sort of rights, and then even organizing for these basic things like having a constitution, having a political party, having liberal representation, you see very quickly that those things that are taken for granted as inalienable human rights in the West are actually in contrast to what a country like Egypt is supposed to serve in the interest of global capital in terms of imperialism. So you very quickly like. And that's one thing I think that needs to be recognized is the fact that you can't just naively say like this is we need to support the Egyptians because they want democracy, because for the Egyptian people or Arab people to have those basic rights, you have to understand why they don't have them to begin with. And it's because people in this
what
side of the world
would will the content of democracy look like in Egypt.
Exactly.
Right? Which would be very different. Egypt is not looking to colonize parts of Canada and have satellite states all around the world. If that's what we mean by democracy in Egypt, then if it's parallel to what we have in Canada, they should be trying to control the world. But they're not. That's not what the democratic aspirations of the Egyptian people are. So we're running out of time. We're actually past nine. Every day I have the blues ready to come on. So final thoughts from each of you. First one, anybody?
Well, I think that, what we were just talking about, I think for one, I mean, it's almost hilarious for the same figures and forces that were behind any number of, violent, predatory, imperial aggressions in the Middle East, behind, all of the horrific ventures that have been pursued by Canada, the United States, and Israel, and Western Europe inside the Middle East, just now, come out, as you said, in support, however patronizing support of the Egyptian protesters. If anything, these entire demonstrations have completely blown asunder, even if we don't, we take it as complete falsitude, this whole notion of democracy promotion and the need for the West to intervene in order to promote and in order for democracy to be implemented in countries, and that the population, if they're the dictators that are armed to the teeth by the United States, will set the order to their benefit, right? It's not like that will take place if they're left alone, and that this whole notion of democracy promotion, responsibility to protect, has been completely, torn asunder by these demonstrations.
Well, I think the biggest contradiction is when you look at when democracy was exported, as we quote unquote, to Iraq in 2003. For there actually to be proper freedom and proper democracy and real social change and political change in Egypt and elsewhere in the Arab world, the relationship between the West and those countries and countries all over the region needs to be really looked at, and the privilege of people here needs to be checked quite significantly.
Absolutely. It's right to revolt, arm the people, let them throw all these dogs into the sea, let Israel go swim after their friends, and let's see true democracy, true popular power flourish in Egypt and all throughout the Middle East. I'm looking to Yemen next. I really want to see
Yemen. Is a very interesting situation.
Salah get thrown out, man. This guy who's bombing his own, who's letting the United States bomb his people
and taking credit for it.
And be like, no, it was me. No, it wasn't the United States. Look over here, it's me, right? Yeah. Anyway, so let's go back to Sheikh Imam, and maybe you can tell us the name of this track one more time.
This is Masri Amma Ya Bahia, which is. Oh, Egypt, the beautiful.
Actually, Kabir had a track for us. You got some local Canadian.
Yeah, man. I'm really. Not to say, but there's this really important track. It is, liberally known as Black History Month. We like to call it here African Liberation Month. There's a track. A really good friend of mine, been doing this for a while now. A really young and inspiring artist, Ili J, and he has a track that he made for Black History Month called "We Gonna Make It." You're gonna hopefully hear this on radio stations throughout the city. Recently, but I want to play it for y'all.
Alright, drop that track. Radio Basics, we're out, and we'll see you next week.
Definitely.
I dedicate this one. This one goes out to all my people in the struggle. Just to let you know that you're gonna see that better day. Feel me? Just keep the faith. Keep your head up. This one for y'all, man. Listen, look. This right here is for my black brothers, class strugglers, niggas wishing they had mothers, who cash smuggle and crack hustle to have supper, cause they ain't giving no jobs, leaving our ass hungry, forcing us either to cheat, steal, or bang covers, then they go and call them badge suckers to handcuff us, man, we just trying to survive what you demand from us, what more you want, cause you already took our land from us, we just making the best given our circumstances, but I'm tired of being ranked under, tired of being class flyers, we can't do mass wonders, just look at our past wonders of our ancestors, like them we all significant, major contributors, we came from a line of rulers, kings and queens, princesses and princes, full of riches, we just gotta get it together, it relies on the mind, stop the black on black crime and treat our women and children right,
right. Always keeping the faith, so every day we pray, we pray, we gonna make it. Lord, Father, be our strength while we endure in this pain, we gon' make it all. Because we living through a struggle for us to see pretty skies, we gotta get through the rain.
Hey, keep your head up, I tell them we gon' make it. I tell them we gon' make it, ain't happening, we gon' make it. Look. This right here is for my black women, sisters and daughters who ain't living with fathers. So y'all search the feeling of male figures and imposters who say they care, but really they couldn't bother. To y'all living single parented or living in foster, that shit ain't proper. Life just seems to be getting harder. But keep your head up, never let up, cause quitters are never victors. Every winner gotta go through some wounds and blisters. Just keep on painting that bigger picture. Even though all the struggling and the rubbish, I know y'all had about enough of it. And that's also for my single mothers who take any job offers just to go home so they could put on upper mitts. Overwork in order to feed their children's stomachs. It's real ugly, ladies. I know y'all don't deserve it. Remember, you are beautiful. Remember what your worth is. Always respect yourself and you gon' get that extra help.
Right. Always keeping the faith. So every day we pray, we pray. No one will be a strength while we endure in this pain, we gon' make it all. Because we living through the struggle for us to see great skies, we gotta get through the rain.
And keep your head up, I tell them we gon' make it.
I tell them we gon' make it,
it ain't happening, we gon' make it.